You're listening to This Motorcycle Life, conversations about why we ride. Episode 41, Horse and Train. I'm Bruce Philp, and thank you for listening. So, are motorcycles losing their souls? Is the romantic allure of these machines on some kind of collision course with something that's faster and safer and easier and maybe more generic? Well, I've posed this question before on this podcast, but this episode's guest comes from a world where that same battle is all but over. His message? Lighten up and ride like an artist. We don't have to choose sides, as long as we can choose our bikes. We'll get to that conversation in a moment, but first, let's take care of some business. Well, I'm kind of running out of ways to say thank you for your support for this podcast, but I can't let an episode go by without doing it. Among this month's emails from listeners were some really kind comments about my difficult conversation with Omar Petralis in the last episode, which I really appreciated. A few new Apple podcast reviews have appeared too, and I'm continually grateful for those because they really help me grow this audience. And honestly, they make me feel pretty good too, so thanks for that. If you want to play an even bigger role in making this podcast happen, here's a few ways you can do that. First, you can sign up for my bi-weekly newsletter. You can do that on this episode's show notes page. You can also stop in at the web store and treat yourself to some TML merchandise, which helps me cover my expenses for doing this. And most of all, especially this month as we mark World Suicide Prevention Day, you can make a donation to the Movember Foundation in the name of this podcast. And I really hope you will. And with that, why don't we get started? When I was in college, I had a poster pinned to the wall of my little apartment of a painting called Horse and Train. It was by a Canadian painter named Alex Colville, and it depicted a horse galloping at full speed along a train track heading directly for an oncoming locomotive. Well, I thought it was profound, in the grandiose way that you do when you're 20. The world was changing, and resistance was futile. The horse was beautiful, but it was doomed, and the train was soulless, but it was inevitable. Well, when it comes to the evolution of the motorcycle, a metaphor like that is probably overdramatic. Still, the cost of progress is a thing that motorcyclists do think about, and sometimes even argue about. The analog past versus the digital future is a theme we've touched on a few times together, most recently and at length with Eric Buell last spring. But it still always leaves me feeling like I'm supposed to pick a side. Well, that's the reason I couldn't resist an episode idea pitched by a listener named Chris Mara. Well, as a motorcyclist, Chris's own garage tells an interesting story all by itself, with five regularly ridden bikes spanning almost 50 years of technological development. One from each food group was how he put it to me. But here was the clincher. Chris happens to be a recording engineer who owns a studio in Nashville called Welcome to 1979. It's a studio that specializes in analog recording, although not exclusively, or as a matter of principle, as you'll hear, and it's in high demand. Chris has spent his career in an industry that stared down the digital train when most motorcycles were still carbureted, an industry that has since found a way to live with what he calls the struggle between analog longing and digital convenience. Well, obviously, I wanted to know how it turned out for that horse, and he seemed like just the person to tell me. I reached Chris Mara at his studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Bruce. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. It's my favorite time of year, so it's hard to catch me in a bad mood, because our weather here is, probably almost as good as your weather there. Don't talk to me in 6 weeks or so, but anyway, long way of saying I'm great. Well, look, thanks for being with me today, and thanks for suggesting that we have this conversation. You know, the appeal of this topic goes straight to my nerdiest side. Your email to me, you know, mostly nailed the assumptions correctly. You know, plus, honestly, thinking about the subject, I'm hoping you can maybe help me figure out where I actually stand on all this or whether I'm, you know, just a big fat hypocrite. So either way, it's going to be fun. at least I'm, you know, not to put too much pressure on you. So I have a disconcertingly long list of questions, so why don't we get into it? And to start us off, I'd love to have you introduce yourself as a motorcyclist. How long have you been riding? How did it start? And you know, what kind of rider are you?
Oh, awesome. I've never introduced myself before like that. Yeah, my name is Chris Mora. I live in Nashville, Tennessee now. I grew up in what I like to call upstate Wisconsin, because it sounds a little classier than northern Wisconsin. and my first motorized vehicle that I owned was a motorcycle. I grew up in rural Wisconsin working on farms, and I got a job milking the cows about 3 miles away. And I used my first couple of paychecks to buy a little Honda 80, XR80cc off-road bike. And that's what I rode to work in all kinds of weather. And then, my friend, lifelong friend, Dustin Booth, and I just started riding motorcycles and kind of grew into bigger off-road bikes. And then I sold my Honda XR350R to go to college. So I watched it get trailered and leave and kind of, you know, cut my hair and went, well, I didn't cut my hair, I went to recording school, but, you know, grew up, quote unquote. And luckily through life, I was able to get back into motorcycles about 7 years ago and just pulled out the checklist and said, wow, I've always wanted a 2000 Indian Chief, black and red. I bought one. And then I was like, well, I've always wanted a Triumph Bonneville. So I bought one used, of course. And now I've got like five bikes and they all have a different little food group they fit into. So, my joke at the recording studio is I just quit buying microphones and started buying motorcycles because they cost about the same.
Yeah, and they're, I guess, guitars are somewhere in the middle there. Tell me what the other three bikes are, because I think that's going to be important context for us later on. You've got the Gilroy Indian, and you've got the Triumph. What else?
Well, I should back chronologically. I have a 70 Honda Super Sport, which is what I bought in the early 2000s, because I couldn't afford a Triumph. So I bought a Honda CB, right? I still have that bike.
Right.
Got the Indian Chief, which I mentioned. I've got the Triumph Bonneville. I've got a Ducati Panigale 899 white. And then I've got my latest acquisition was about this time last year. I bought a 83 BMW R80 that, the owner, previous owner had bobbed perfectly, to the point where he painted accents on it that were gold, which were almost the same gold as my analog tape machine restoration company brands our tape machines with. So it was like a match made in heaven. So I've got a wide array of motorcycles that each do a different thing.
Yeah, it's a pretty great set, I have to say. Yeah. I love that Panigale in white. We'll talk a bit about that later. And it's so awesome to pick up a custom bike that's been done, you know, just right. Usually if they're perfect, they're not for sale. And if they're for sale, they aren't perfect. So good on you. I'd love to see pictures, actually. Okay, cool. So, and as our final bit of context, this may seem kind of strange, but it won't be. I'm curious to have you tell us a little bit about Welcome to 1979.
Sure. It's a recording studio that my wife and I own, and we've had it here in Nashville for 13 years. And it's a large recording studio. The space itself dedicated for recording is about 6,000 square feet, maybe a little bit more. And it's nestled in about 12,000 square feet that we lease for all of our businesses. And it's a, as you can imagine by the name, it's a retro feeling studio that focuses on recording on analog tape, but also we're cutting edge with all computer recording facets.
Nice. I watched a video of a, I guess it was titled Studio Tour or something like that. And it struck me as an amazing place. It kind of made me wish I'd spent my life a little bit differently, but that's another another interview for another day. I'm curious to know why you build it. You called it at some point, maybe during that interview, you referred to it as a studio frozen in time. What made you want to do that?
Well, you know, it's a lot of things, and we're all on a journey, right? And when I moved to Nashville, I was 20 and I was soaking in all the different things that recording and music have to offer. And that led me down a path of being a freelance recording engineer, which is an awesome existence because every day almost I'm in a different recording studio, recording a different artist for a different producer. Right. So just imagine that. Right.
Yeah.
And you, I liken it to going to restaurants or bars and you look around, right, while you're waiting for your entree. And even though you have no desire to own a restaurant, you still look at the lighting and the tabletops and you think, well, if I had a restaurant, I wouldn't do that. Or if I had a restaurant, I would do that. You know what I mean? So 10 years of that, and then 10 or more. And then also my niche became recording self-contained independent bands who are not really comfortable in a studio. So I spent a lot of my time getting them comfortable in these studios that were built to be impressive. But you take the coin that says impressive and you turn it over and the other side is intimidation. So right. And recording is very unnatural. That's part of, you know, you've mentioned on your podcast being nervous, and it's recording is a, it's only been part of humans for like 100 years, mm-hmm. right? So when it came time to own my own studio or build my own studio, I wanted it spacious. I wanted it comfortable. And that kind of just happened organically. It's like people are most comfortable at their house or on wearing older t-shirts and ripped up jeans and comfortable furniture. You know what I mean? And that's this place. It's 1979. It's gold couches that were bought at yard sales that you sit in them, not on them. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not, and this is kind of why I emailed you. It's not, I'm not a Luddite. I'm not anti anything, especially technology. But I wanted a safe place that was comfortable, that the aesthetic matched. You know what I mean?
Right.
You don't want this studio and there's a receptionist there and a foyer. There's not, or, a, you know, there's not that. You walk in to your session. And again, you know, a lot of bands have an older guitar and an older amp and going for a certain sound, and to not take care of where that guitar and amp reside when you record, I thought someone should take a lot more care than that.
Right. And of course the comfortableness is just the beginning of the story, right? I mean, I think one of the main reasons we're talking is that the gear is also from that era, or largely from that era. Yeah. And so tell me about that.
Well, it just kind of occurred to me that, you know, the recording console that I acquired for the space was built in 1978. The analog tape machine I had was in 1981. Some quick math, you know, it was like 19, you know, whatever. And I said, well, that's what we'll do. So welcome to this, right? And then the equipment I had been gathering for a while anyway. And a lot of people have a misconception that there's like hard and fast rules about what equipment that I buy for the studio. And that's not the case. It's, if it's really cool and sounds really good and I can afford to buy it and keep the space affordable to the bands I want to record, then I buy it. regardless of what my wife wants me to do. And so there is some vintage gear and there's some new gear, and but the newer stuff is really good too.
Mm.
You know, so my joke is if they would have had this microphone or this computer in 1979, I would have bought it.
Right. Which I'm actually going to ask you about later on, because what I think made the suggestion for this episode fun was this idea of analog versus digital. And I guess a sort of presumption that that their musicians and motorcyclists might have something in common in this regard. I wonder, maybe this is the time to ask that question. What do you think musicians and motorcyclists have in common? What is it about what you do versus your, you know, your passion as a rider that made you reach out?
I think the reason I reached out, one, as a fan, which I'm not stroking you, Bruce. I think you're an artist, and I like to reach out and tell people that I think they're doing a good job, and they're doing a good job.
Oh, thank you.
Because a lot of the emails that people get, regardless of their profession, are to resolve an issue that resides with their profession, right? And that can warp your sense of worth, right? So I try to take time out of my day, and I listen to your podcast. So this is great. And so there was that. And then I had noticed kind of a trend in the discussions about what era of bikes do you like to ride, and what is riding with the nanny stuff with the computerized portions of the motorcycles. And it was like a light bulb went off. It's like, wow, those are like the conversations I have in the studio or on the panels I have in my industry. And then thirdly was I really did tie into the musical aspect that you bring to your podcast. It was slightly veiled, but I knew it was there. You mentioned that you got to go to the studio to see an artist record. And I'm like, I got someone here who digs music and recording. So maybe I'll wedge in.
podcast. I think so. You're being modest. It was a good idea, because as we'll get to, my affection for modern digital stuff on motorcycles and my affection for old fashioned stuff on motorcycles seem unreconciled. So we're going to kind of pick that apart a bit. And that's why I was so tickled by your suggestion. Now when you wrote me, you used a phrase that kind of caught my attention. You talked about what you called the struggle between analog longing and digital convenience. And suggested that motorcyclists have this struggle too. What happens in a recording studio that reminds you of motorcycle culture? Is that a clear question? I can never tell.
Yeah. I think, okay. What happens in a recording studio that reminds me of motorcycle culture? Yes. And it's that I get pigeonholed all the time because of the studio that I have, that I'm anti-computers or don't know how to record on a computer, or will dictate how we record based on what equipment I want to use, right? Much like I feel when I'm on my Ducati, I get a look from a guy on a bagger that I'm, oh, you're one of those guys. And it's like, well, my other bike is more old school than your bike.
Right.
But you don't know that, 'cause you're looking at me in this snapshot, right? And I talk really openly about that in the studio, not out on the road, right? But in the studio, it's like, however you want to record, I've spent my life learning stuff. And it really does take people aback when I'm teaching a course on analog recording. And in that lesson, I teach them some tricks about computer recording, and it really throws people off. And to me, it's all the same, right? And the convenience thing I mentioned, like much like motorcycles, if I only recorded on with an analog tape machine, that's all I did, I would get frustrated and I wouldn't enjoy it as much. And if I only recorded with a computer with all the fancy gadgets, I would become bored and wouldn't enjoy it. So I make sure I'm doing both equally. And then when I switch, it's like, oh yeah, here we go. Right. This is fun. And then, okay. Or now I get to do this in a computer that I couldn't do on analog tape. And I have all these ideas to do. Right. And, you know, in my, with my motorcycles, it's like, okay, my Indian Chief is the analog tape machine and the Ducati is the computer. Mm-hmm. Right. And you ride them differently, but you're still riding.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder if maybe you're riding them for different reasons. I'm towards the end of this, towards the end of this interview, I'm going to ask you how you pick, how you decide what bike to ride in a given day. Here's a question. It's a little bit out of context, but I feel like it might help us along here. I hear what you're saying about being kind of agnostic and, you know, creatively driven about choosing the equipment you're going to use on a given day. But I also know you have a business restoring vintage tape machines, and there's clearly some affection there for, for physical machines, if I can use that, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of shortcut. So I wonder if you think, and you know, to disclose my bias here, I love that stuff. I love buttons that click and knobs that, you know, I've got 5 remotes for my home theater system and I'm fine with that. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be. I'm that guy. So I wonder if you think that the machines themselves inspire this longing, or whether we crave them, to use a word that you've used, because there's something missing. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. And that, whatever that is, I haven't found a name for it yet. Whatever that is exists in almost everything that I do from a business standpoint. The recording studio, analog tape machines, I'm heavily involved in the vinyl record manufacturing world. And that tactile, that ownership, that interfacing with your machine or turntable is whatever it is, right? And I'm not that bright, and I tend to do things and then learn about what it is I'm doing or why as I'm doing them, right? And just a few years ago, I was interviewed by a magazine, and then a magazine showed up at my house, and it was really glossy. I think it was called Gear or Men's Gear or something. And it was a really nice magazine. And I'm like, why did I get this? And I thumbed through it and I saw a gorgeous Norton motorcycle. And I was like, wow, like a full spread. And I read the whole article. It was about NYC Norton. And then I was like, that's amazing. And then I turned the page and it was a full spread on Mara machines, my analog tape machines, and me. And I'm like, oh, I have a lifestyle brand.
Oh, dear. I mean? Yes, I do.
I'm like that, and it was this huge awakening. It's like, because people, the topic of how does a tape machine sound versus a computer has washed away from my day to day years ago, and I couldn't figure out why. And it's like, this is a lifestyle. I want to experience recording in a different way. Back to the NYC Norton. So I emailed Kenny and I was like, hey man, we're in the magazine together. I'd love what you do and check out what I do. And he's like, I used to play keyboards, and we became friends. So, cause he's a music guy, you know, but I'm digressing so much, I'm spinning out, but it's a lifestyle thing, you know? Mm. So,
yeah, I get that, and it feels that way to me too. The danger I see in that characterization is that it risks trivializing it, and I don't think it is trivial. So I thought maybe what I would do, so just to keep myself from from digressing madly, because it's such, you know, this is a collision of two worlds I love, is I kind of divided the next bunch of questions into 3 themes. You know, each of which kind of represents a thing that people, or at least I, kind of feel, find appealing about old bikes and old stuff in general. And so what I thought I'd do is ask you these questions from your point of view as a motorcyclist who lives in this parallel world that we talked about earlier. And so I apologize if it seems kind of structured. And if we get fascinated by something and tear off in another direction, that's cool too. But I thought I'd at least give it a try.
Let's cover some ground. Yeah.
Sure. Cool. Okay. So the first theme has to do with, I used the word tactile a minute ago, and I like that word a lot. The word that that I wrote down on my notes here was sort of interaction with the machine. So I caught a phrase, fingers on strings, hands on faders. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, that was one of my first slogans for the studio. Yeah.
Yeah. So it sort of suggests this reverence for, kind of doing things manually. I think there are a lot of riders who relish the amount of physical interaction that it takes to ride a motorcycle. And I see this sometimes with guitarists too, but I don't want to kind of over-till that soil. But there's a sense of accomplishment or even kind of feeling special, if you like, that goes with moving a machine down the road while you're manipulating four different levers at the same time besides steering the bike. And I guess the older a bike is, that maybe the truer that is. As bikes get older, you get kickstarters and chokes, and there's a lot more mechanical maintenance involved. And if you go back far enough, riders are actively managing fuel mixture. So I think there's some level of intrinsic satisfaction in that, quite apart from the simple result, if you like. So assuming that you agree this is true, and maybe you don't, is there a parallel in music, and why do you think that that unnecessary interactivity appeals to us?
It's a really good question. I have not been asked that before. I think it has to do with ownership of it, kind of cradled with not everyone can do it, but not in the elitist way. Right.
Right.
And this may answer the previous question too. It's like, if you understand what a choke is and when to use it and that you have to kickstart your bike and what to do with the throttle when you do that, that's more your bike, right?
Hmm.
And a carbureted bike has more of a personality. It's a little different day to day. You have to ride it a little bit different day to day. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
And guitar is the same way, right? Not everyone can play a vintage guitar. Because you have to understand intonation and that it goes out. You have to adjust the nut and the bridge and all that kind of stuff, right?
Hmm.
And know that you have an intonation problem and how to fix it during a session or a gig, you know? So, I think that's the parallel there.
Right. And the appeal is that we're somehow more personally connected to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I've certainly met plenty of riders who have old bikes that are more like relatives than they are like, tools or toys. So that kind of tracks, which I guess leads me to the next question. And the question has to do with stakes. So I wonder if the idea that the stakes are higher with old machines has anything to do with this. So let me explain what I mean. I think maybe bikes and recorded music sort of share a historical arc and lots of other things in which the imperative to get things right the first time has become less urgent. I'm old enough to remember, cutting film on a flatbed, for example, and you don't get a lot of second chances in a process like that. When we choose the old ways of doing things, because it is a choice now, we're choosing for no good functional reason to take a risk because it makes the process matter, if that makes sense. And so it's that one take kind of idea, so to speak, that, recording directly to, to Vine. Do you agree with that? Is there a thrill in the fact that that the stakes are higher?
I don't know if I can swear or not on this podcast. I feel like saying, hopefully, F word right now. I've never thought of it like that, Bruce, but it is absolutely true.
Hmm.
I'm a teacher. I'm an encourager. I want people to learn how to do what I do, right? So this is not like a fear-based conversation about recording on analog tape. But when I'm recording a band on analog tape, it is a destructive recording method.
Hmm.
And if you're playing guitar, Bruce, and I'm recording, and you say, "Hey, Chris, I messed up on that on the first chorus. Can you drop me in for the first chorus?" I have to mentally listen to the musical bars leading up to that chorus to make sure that I can get you in where you want. talk with you about, oh, wait a second, you hold a big chord before that. Do you want that one, right? Because once I'm recording, I'm erasing. And that puts me in the moment. I'm having a conversation with you. My phone is off. We're off to the side, right? Mm. And if I make a mistake, I have to hit a button and that talks to you in your headphones and say, hey, Bruce, I know we discussed the top of the chorus. I accidentally punched in a bar early. You weren't playing right. Now we need to get that one right. And I have to own it. And we have to do more, right? Much like riding motorcycles. It's like, I'm taking this corner. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I have to pay attention to what I'm doing. It's a higher risk, higher focus situation, right? If you're driving a car and you're texting and you run onto the shoulder, you just go back on the road. No harm, no foul. You might have hit somebody, not a big deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But no one will ever know that you ran off onto the shoulder for a second. You know, on a motorcycle, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, that parallel is there, and that's what I like about recording on tape. I'm just more involved in the session. I'm more present. I find that I know the songs better because I have to know how many bars are in each verse and chorus and, you know, all that kind of stuff for these explicit reasons. Just like on a motorcycle, you're looking further down the road. You're looking in the ditches. You're, you know what I mean? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you take ABS and, you know, traction control and all that stuff out of the equation, you know, they don't give you as much margin as maybe you think they're going to, but it definitely, as you put it, puts you more in the moment. And there's a certain thrill in that.
Yeah. And again, a little bit going back a little bit in our conversation, and not everyone can do it, right? Not everyone can record well on an analog tape machine and do all the things the artist wants to do. And not everybody can ride a motorcycle. Everyone can learn. You come over, you sit in the studio, I'll teach you how to do it in a few hours. And then you're set up to make mistakes that you'll learn more from. Mm-hmm. Much like motorcycles. I can show someone how to ride a motorcycle in an hour. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. And that fascinates me. I have a little bit of writing in my background, and I know lots of people who write. And there are people who are deeply committed to writing on typewriters because although it's possible to change and correct things, you definitely have to be more committed when you hit the key. I was always happier to write on a computer because it meant that nothing was sacred. I could just try stuff and be fearless. And, you know, they're different experiences, both valid. And both, I suspect, you know, I guess the typewriter guy's experience is more intimidating to me than mine would be to him. But anyway, a long digressive way of saying I understand your answer, and I think that sounds right to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever think about, do you think there's an electric motorcycle in your future? I wonder where we put that on the continuum, because they seem to subtract even more interaction, right? There's no clutch, you know, how do you have feelings about that yet? Or is it just not in your radar?
Oh, it's on my radar. Cause again, conflicted, right? Mm. So I watched a whole YouTube video on the Honda Goldwing with the automatic transmission, whatever it's called. And I was like, well, that's a load of crap. You know, it's a motorcycle. It shouldn't be automatic. And then this old biker gets on there and he says the same thing. He loves it. And then I caught myself. It's like, well, that's, you know, that's a computer, right? That's a computerized version of a motorcycle, right? And maybe it's a different experience. And then that person now likes that better. Motorcycles, a fundamental part of motorcycle riding is acceleration, which electric motors have for days. Like,
right.
Instant acceleration, instant torque, all the specs are there. There's just no noise.
Yep. You know what
I mean? Yes. So I'm dying to ride one. I really am. Mm. And because the first time I was in a Tesla, it was shocking. The gentleman just, I didn't know what a Tesla was, you know. I called the studio and asked if I had a Tesla charging station, and I had no idea what he was talking about. I didn't know if he meant I could plug in his phone or what. And he showed up and went for a ride and he stepped on the accelerator, not the gas pedal, accelerator. And all I heard was my body going into the leather seat and wind. It was amazing, you know, of what I wasn't hearing. So I'm dying to ride an electric motorcycle.
Yeah, I'm curious too, because I have to confess that my initial reaction to the idea is a bit, was a bit hesitant. And I think the problem is my vanity. So here's what I mean by that. To me, the need to interact with a machine in a physical way or in a tactile way implies the need for some manual skill. You have to know how to do something, and you have to have the dexterity and the hand-eye coordination to complete that task in a repeatable, predictable way. And so skill raises the barrier to entry, and some people might argue that's appropriate, and that the easier the tools are to use, the more people are going to try their hand at it, and, ad absurdum, that might not be a good thing. I think that's probably true of music. I mean, it certainly seems that way from the outside. So what prevented me from being attracted to electric motorcycles in the first place was my vanity at being, proud of the skill I'd acquired. And so I think you may have just half answered this question. What do you think about that? Is this barrier to entry thing a good thing, or is it bad, or just a distraction?
Yeah, there's people in my industry that rattle their sabers about barrier of entry and home studio recordings ruining the industry and all that. And, the proof's in the pudding. If you make a bad recording, it doesn't matter. You can use anything to make a bad recording or a good one, And it just came into my mind that today my Facebook memory was 12 years ago, me recording this awesome band in my hometown in this barn that my friend Dustin, I mentioned earlier, owned. And I brought my laptop and some equipment, and I had this amazing 3-week record making thing, right? And if I would have been, we have to record on tape and bring a recording console, it wouldn't have happened at all. So my laptop recording rig allowed me to have a whole experience I couldn't have had with music had I been focused on recording a certain way. Turn that into an electric motorcycle, maybe I'm going to have this whole new experience of riding, hit a tree faster, I don't know, on an electric motorcycle.
Right.
At the end of the day, I ride it and I like it, then I can better define what I don't like about it, because I have ridden bikes with no technology except a canceling turn signal. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's a thorny, I don't mean naughty like bad, but naughty like knots in wood kind of problem. Because I think I read somewhere that you, among the people who have recorded at your studio, was Pete Townsend, and that he came there for the analog experience, which seemed almost like, watch what I can do without the crutches. I'm choosing that word, but it felt to me like there was a kind of benign vanity in that choice. Am I reading that right?
Well, full disclosure, he's a client of my tape machine company, Mara Machine, and called me for a recommendation for a studio because he was coming to Nashville. And I said, first he says, "Hey, Chris, it's Pete Townsend. Do you have a minute?"
Yes.
Yeah, hold on, but I said, I own a studio, and I gave him the name, and then he called back and he looked it up and he goes, "That looks like my kind of place," is what he said. So, I think he, so it's a humble story, but I think he came because he knew that I am involved, and he has four of my machines and trusts that. And it is his kind of a thing, right?
Right.
But man, what a joy working with him and learning from him, So.
Yeah, of that world. I mean, I guess I was projecting a little bit, but maybe that brings us to the second theme I wanted to poke at a little bit, which I'll call sort of beautiful imperfection, if that makes sense. So, a bit of a story. A million years ago, I worked for Techniques, actually. About the time things were becoming digital. So I'm thoroughly dating myself here. And I remember arguing forcefully that this was the future, that music is going to be better if we can photograph it instead of, painting it, if you like. And then many years later, I kind of caved in and got a turntable because it was, a thing people were doing. And I found myself, to my own surprise, completely charmed by the whole thing, you know, including all the problems that digital recording was supposed to solve. You know, I liked having to lower the tone arm, you know, and I liked the pops and crackles, and I liked the, you know, the challenges that they have with dynamic range and all that stuff. It was pleasurable to me, despite me having been, you know, an advocate for its obsolescence. So I'm kind of wondering if that was just sentimentality, or whether you, so we'll talk about audio for the moment, and then we'll ask about motorcycles next. Do you think that was just sentimentality, or did we actually lose something along the way that I kind of stumbled on?
You mean in your own experience buying a turntable?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, because it's not a perfect format on records, right? But people tend to like it. And I mean, I think it's the interaction. You know, there's not a lot of joy in pulling up your phone and playing someone a song that, you know, there's a lot more joy to say, check out this record, put on a turntable, hand them the jacket. Mm. You know what I mean? And the, I'll call it a skill to like play track two on a record. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Versus, it's actually kind of hard to actually hit it perfect, you know,
right.
In that little space that the vinyl mastering engineer leaves you. But I think it starts maybe with sentiment, or what is the big deal? Like, why is everyone talking about this? Right. Cause younger people buy them that haven't had them before. So there's no sentiment there. Right. And then you get an appreciation or not, I don't know. So,
yeah, I thought I'd be a more critical listener, but you know, all that stuff people were saying about, oh, it's the sound is warmer and more natural. I was buying it, and you know, so I kind of wondered whether that was me setting myself up, you know, or if it was an experience I was actually having. So now I guess we need to answer that question for motorcycles. So if motorcycles were objective things, which I absolutely don't think they are, we would have to say that new ones are better than old ones. They're faster, they're more reliable, they're quieter, they're easier on gas, they're easier to operate, and on and on and on. But I wonder if we left something on the table with motorcycles the way some would argue we did with recorded music, do you think we left something on the table, and what do you think that, and if so, what do you think that was?
What do you mean left it on the table?
So I guess maybe mostly it's this sensory experience, right? So I guess what I'm trying to get at is, in our quest for, you know, mechanical perfection and Euro 5 compliance, you know, have we sacrificed character? Maybe that's a better way to put it.
Yeah. Oh, we lost something. Okay. Yeah. You know, I think so the word you used was better a minute ago, and that's such a subjective term. Like, what is better, right?
Right.
Are vinyl records better? Are new motorcycles better? What do you want? What is it, right? If you want all the songs that were ever recorded ever in your pocket, vinyl records are horrible because, you know, you couldn't acquire that in a lifetime when you can for $12 a month with Spotify. You know, do you like a new motorcycle because if it, there's an error code, you can take it to the dealer and they can fix it. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
I was just riding my older Indian with the last weekend with a bunch of the newer Indians, and we got on the interstate and they were gone, buddy, like gone.
Right.
And for a moment I'm like, those bikes are better. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then we stop at a gas station and three people walk over and look at my bike and not theirs. And I'm like, well, maybe mine's better. And mine is paid for. So that's way better. And so that's a tough question. And I think the answer is the long game. Okay. Because we can experience the new motorcycles and always have new and always have new, and they will bring new features to our experience. And then we can decide what's better. And, you know, maybe like, let's just pick on electric motorcycles for a second, or imagine where that's going to go, right? Okay, well, don't they have sound? Okay, cool. You know what I mean? Much like Tesla has in their cars now, you can just dial in a sound that you're going to hear.
Right.
You know what I mean? In your car, it's all fake, you know? But then you can change it, you know? But we have to experience the new to say, oh, I wish it had this too, you know?
Mm. Your comment about the fake sound kind of tweaked me. I wonder, it's funny that the word authenticity hasn't come up in this conversation yet. Does that have intrinsic value?
Does authenticity have intrinsic value in motorcycles or what I do recording-wise?
Well, either.
Yeah, I think the bands I record, they use the word real a lot, R-E-A-L, and I don't. You know, they're like, yeah, it's just time we make a record for real, you know, like record for real. And I don't use that word. I'm not exclusive as far as like excluding people from my process or saying recording on a computer in your home is not real. Right.
Right.
But I see these same bands, typically the, you know, mid-20s dudes, at the bar telling the girls they recorded on tape and they puff up their chests. You know what I mean? Like the girls even know, right? Or care, you know? And much like motorcycles, it's like a lot of guys ride motorcycles thinking the girls care and girls don't care, you know? Right? But you know, they're having more fun and telling themselves they can do it and learn how to do it,
right?
You know? I think, and you said it earlier, skill is if I learn a new hobby and it requires skill to learn, and then I now have that, I feel better about myself and I've grown, you know? And motorcycles is in that category. I'm still learning how to ride better and all that. And analog tape recording, when people come to the studio for our tape camps and I teach people how to record on analog tape, however they learn, I can teach them, and then they've learned how to record differently,
right,
in a new way, and they're thrilled, so,
right,
and more authentic, so.
Yeah, which I think sometimes, you know, people use the term bragging rights. It's a little bit pejorative, but there's definitely an element of social capital involved in this. You see it in all kinds of, you know, hobbyist worlds, cars and bikes and music, and I think there's a bit of that at work there too. I want to let me see how to phrase this. So you compared the kind of ephemeral nature of a vinyl record to a footprint in the sand in an interview that I watched. Don't recall which one it was exactly, but the phrase caught my eye because I thought it was kind of poetic and lovely. And I'm wondering whether you might apply that to a motorcycle. So you have two bikes that I would say are legitimately old, the CB and the BMW. Mm-hmm. And so you've got a carb and a choke to contend with, and it probably smells, and it probably takes a minute to warm up before you can ride it. But, you know, they may also leak and you know, may have trouble with modern gasoline, who knows. But they almost certainly don't run the way they did when they were brand new. So, you know, this gets a little bit of Zen philosophy here, but I wonder if decay is part of the attraction. Do you have the courage to field that rather sloppy question?
Yeah, and we see it in audio all the time, as far as longing for what things used to be and how they operated then, to the point. And listeners won't believe me, but you can Google it. You can buy very expensive vintage 9-volt batteries for your guitar pedals that somehow operate, I'm going to guess, at a lower voltage, and thus your pedal will sound a little more decayed, right?
Mm.
And they build these brown boxes or boxes that you plug your amplifier in that will reduce the amount of voltages it goes to them, because when that guitar amp was designed, it was 109 volts coming out of the wall, not 125. You know what I mean? So you dial it down so it will have to work harder, you know? And I think when I ride the CB and when I ride behind the CB, with my son Max, who's learning to ride on it. I picked that bike from Learn on a Ride because it's not fast, and it's not as fast as it used to be. There's no way, right? And if he tips it over at a stop sign, it's just an old bike, right? And then that's his dent in his story, right?
Right.
Instead of with my nice bikes. But I often ride that now that I've had other bikes. I'm like, was this fast then? Like, did they think this was fast? You know? And it's like, well, it smokes a little. It probably doesn't have compression like it should. I don't know. So it's a curiosity too. Like, I wonder what this would do if it was freshened up, you know? Mm. But then you twist your wrist and you wait, and then it happens. You know what I mean? And that's kind of fun, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Yeah. So there's a bit of a kind of time machine magic going on there, but I do understand the question. Well, I wonder what this was like when it was new. Cause I really, who knows, right? The people who rode them back then probably don't have objectively perfect memories about it either.
Cause I've only had that bike. I've had the bike since like 1999. And I remember thinking it was fast. Mm. Like when, you know what I mean? But today I was riding this morning on my Bonneville and I was doing 90 miles an hour and I went for sixth gear. You know what I mean? And it doesn't have a sixth gear. And I didn't do that on that bike before I had my Ducati. You know what I mean? I thought 90 was fast. I knew it was a fifth gear.
Right.
You know what I mean? There wasn't anything beyond that. You know what I mean?
It's so true.
I've changed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We are an element in this calculus too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've all gone home or our old high school and go, man, this football field was a lot bigger. And it's like, no, it's 100 yards, dude. You know, it's the same. You know what I mean? So, but while we're on this topic of decay, I was listening to, oh man, I'm so bad with names, Bruce. The podcast you did with the photographer. And she was talking.
Amy Shore. Yeah.
Yeah. So she was talking about that April Fool's prank that Porsche did with a patina car and patina and what patina means. It's a story. Well, there's this whole segment of guitars that are they're sold new and they're expensive and they're relict. They are and that's what they call it.
Mm.
They're made to look old and made to look played and made to look like you had it forever and you're a good guitar player. And they're called relics and a relict or whatever. And to me, it's just the goofiest thing I've ever seen, you know, but it makes sense. It's like, you want to have that guitar that makes you look like this is your 9,000 gig.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we all put on a brand new leather jacket and decide not to buy it because it looks too new. Right?
Yeah. We're all a bit guilty. I mean, I wouldn't probably choose one of those guitars either, but it's not that I don't get it. I think even Fender's done this, right? I think they even had they reproduced Stevie Ray Vaughan's number one, right?
Yeah. And, but I'm talking about like they make one let, like the paint's wore off and the neck is like wore down and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's painted like at the factory.
Right. So, you know, just to kind of prove that you know, I'm no better than anybody else, I have a Triumph Scrambler, which is the same year as your Bonneville, which is why I chuckled when you mentioned the lack of a sixth gear. And I would say it's my most analog bike. It has electronic fuel injection, but otherwise, it could have been built any time in the last 40 years. So, and you know, like on that bike, I can feel this little surge around 3,600 RPM where the fuel maps transition from one to the next. And I know that's happening and it's an imperfection, but I guess it's kind of charming because I know what's going on. But it's not as immersive as riding your BMW or your CB would be. So I wonder if you think, and I think maybe I know the answer already. I wonder if you think, am I just indulging in nostalgia light? I mean, that bike is a fake old bike, really. I mean, I adore it, but it's a fake old bike. Is there a spectrum for this? Are we just in the middle of some kind of ugly transition from analog to digital that nobody will remember fondly? So in other words, I guess, am I kidding myself thinking that this is kind of like an old bike, or is this legit?
Well, to skew it in your direction, a Triumph is a fantastic motorcycle that's timeless, right?
Yeah.
There's something about it. I was riding mine this morning, and it's just like, you know, this is just a this is the easiest bike to ride. It's so fantastic. You know what I mean? And they did, ours are the same year. So you're, it looks like a carburetor. You know what I mean?
Yep.
That has an injector in it. So it looks very old school. No one knows what year it is. So it's, you know, a little skewed comment, but yeah, you know, I think everyone longs for yesteryear and then they go, oh, this is what it was. Like, ride this bike. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, yeah. Like, tape machine business, we restore one era of the tape machines. And they're, I joke, it's the modern era, right? 1980s, right?
Right.
But, and everyone's like, well, why don't you do these? Like, a 74 MCI JH100. It's like, because if that thing was working perfectly, you'd hate it. You'd absolutely hate it. You know what I mean? It doesn't locate back to where it should. You can't record in and out without it you hearing it. You know what I mean? It's just you want more from what this can do from the factory.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
So, but on the digital side, you know, it's like the Ducati has quick shift, right? You don't have to use the clutch when you upshift. And I thought, well, I'm going to lose a little bit there, right? But I'm telling you, Bruce, my favorite thing is like 11,000 RPM, 100 some miles an hour, and you hit a gear and you know, no clutch, just jam it with the throttle wide open. It's an experience you can't get on any other bike. So
yeah,
come down.
Well, and I understand. So, I mean, my relationship with the Triumph is sort of like, I understand this is a kind of sanitized, you know, nostalgia, but the fact is that when I ride it, I feel, you know, like I'm 20 again, and how do you put a price on that? But I have another bike with a quick shifter as well, and I'm well aware that it's a crutch. I don't use it all the time, but just as you say, when your goal is maximum acceleration, it's bliss, right?
Yeah.
So I just wonder whether the whole idea of ideology, you know, in this debate is you know, maybe kind of flawed at the most fundamental level. You know, I was thinking about your Panigale, and I kind of wondered. So you talked about having a bike in every food group when we first connected, and I took that in part to mean that you know your bike's kind of bracket a 50 years of motorcycle history, and that bike was state of the art when it was new. But things like IMUs for cornering ABS and traction control were still mostly in the future, and if I'm not mistaken, that bike does not have those things. I wonder, do you ever get the itch? So in the spirit of, I'm going to put brackets around this era. Do you ever get the itch to update that bike so that you've got the most modern, kind of opposite to the older bikes, or do you think of it that way?
I do. And again, that bike's paid for, so it's a big motivator.
Right.
but it's, I know it doesn't have those things, right? Cause I've ridden the new BMW. R1100, and it's really smooth, and you're like, wow, that corner was easy. And they're so advanced, you don't know what's going on, you don't feel any of that, right? And then you're like, wow, I'm a great rider, that was awesome,
right?
You know what I mean?
Right.
And as curious as I am to ride a brand new Panigale, I feel the danger in mine. Like, it will wheelie. You downshift too fast and the back end kicks around. It doesn't rev match. You know what I mean? It does all that. You know what I mean? But you don't appreciate that until you ride a bike that does it for you. You know? So I think for me right now, it's a really nice blend of the technology. Cause I can change how much, engine braking and all that kind of stuff. Software, I don't really do it, right? Like, the thing that you get with all the gadgets, you never really do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, you mentioned a second ago about the quick shift being a crutch, and there's a difference between a crutch and a tool. Even though I know someone's rolling their eyes, a crutch is a tool, but
like, not me.
It's like, I told you I'm not that bright. But if I'm recording in a computer and I want to try something that I think might not work, and I try it knowing I have the undo button, that's me using it as a tool. If I'm not paying attention to your needs as an artist and make a mistake and go, you can just undo it, that's a crutch, right? If I'm jamming down the interstate, rocking my quick shift, because I really want to get that, because you can't use a clutch at 11,000 RPMs. You can't. You know what I mean? And yep. Stay on the throttle,
yep.
Right? Yep. I'm using it as a tool, then that's a different experience. It's not, maybe this is self-serving. I don't feel like I need it and can't ride a bike without it. I'm riding better with it.
Right.
You know? So, I don't know, just a distinction there for my own self-worth.
Yeah. Well, it's just, vanity always lurks in the wings when you get into this stuff. But I feel exactly the same way. I'll never do a wheelie probably in my life, but for some reason, yeah. I'm comforted to know that I can whack on the throttle, with my newest motorcycle and the front wheel won't come off the ground. And yeah, I feel like a rock star for 5 minutes.
That's a funny, just real quick segment. So I got back from a motorcycle trip with my friend Neil Capolino, and my son Max, who's 14, said, "Did you have a good time?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Do you like riding with Neil?" I said, "Yeah, he's a really good motorcycle rider." And my 14-year-old son, right, think 14 years old, he's like, "Oh, you can do like wheelies and stuff?" And I was like, "No." This, to me, I said the opposite of a good motorcycle rider is someone who does wheelies.
Right.
Neil stays on a blind spot. He rides safe. We can ride at different speeds, and I'm confident in his decision making. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
I know, but I still I still have there's a few people that get on my motorcycle when I get on my motorcycle, and one of them is definitely 14. When we were exchanging emails, you told me, and this is a quote, the studio, vinyl records, and tape machines all have the same soul that motorcycles have. Neither makes any sense to own or use, but people crave them and hold them in high regard. After 25 years in the music business, I'm just now starting to understand why. So, end quote. So I feel like it's fair to ask you this terrible question, which is, would you care to take a stab at defining soul?
Man. Yeah, I mean, if I can do this right, I'll be Pope, I guess.
Right, or something.
Or something. Finally make it into sainthood. I think it has to do, man, and I did in my email, I did say I'm beginning to understand, so give me a little wide berth here.
Absolutely.
But it has something to do with, like, approachability, and this appropriate interaction and ease of use. Okay. Like a tape machine you can walk up to, like when I speak at audio conventions, like recording conventions, I bring a tape machine with me, and these things are the size of a washing machine. I bring them up on stage and I just say, who's never used a tape machine before? And a whole bunch of hands go up. I'm like, I call someone up and we're looking at it, it's on. I'm like, how do you think you put this thing into play? And they're like, well, there's a play button. I said, well, go ahead and hit it. You know, that whole thing, it's super easy. but it's big, it's purpose built. You know what I mean? This, and easily replaced, right? This tape machine that's the size of a washing machine only records on two channels, left and right. And it's replaced by a Technics CD player.
Right.
Or an iPod. Or your phone or whatever, but none are purpose built. Like a phone is not purpose built to play music, right? Motorcycle has been replaced 1,000 times, right? And they still, I mean, how many motorcycle companies are there?
Yeah.
30? I don't know. You know, and there's even people, Bruce, with podcasts about motorcycles.
Imagine that.
So I think that's the soul, like a soul, like you don't hear the word soul very often without someone saying they're an old soul. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe, and I'm way out on a limb here, Bruce, but I think a soul means something that has everlasting life. And I think if something like somebody set out to absolutely replace an analog tape machine, and they did, and someone set out to replace a motorcycle, it's like, hey, I want to sit next to somebody with a roof, done. Right? But the motorcycle still exists and still thrives, and the analog tape machine, at least in my world and my sales numbers, still survive. There's a soul.
Yeah.
How's that?
It's good. It's good. I buy it. It's funny. I was thinking while you were talking back on my brief time in the audio business all those years ago, and I remember putting CD players in front of consumers and saying, you know, basically, look how much better than a vinyl record this is. It's so easy, and you can scratch a disc and it'll still play, and you can, you know, drill a hole through it and it'll still play, and isn't that awesome? And what consumers would say over and over again is that this is great, but why can't you record with it?
right.
So it kind of, it raises the possibility that there might be a certain personality that sees soul in things that are purpose built, but that it's not, you know, kind of in quotes, normal. I know, interesting. So I guess that kind of brings us to the third theme that I thought might be worth talking about, which is nostalgia, kind of in the purest sense of the word. You know, that word has its roots in, I think it means the pain of remembering or something like that. This kind of longing for the past, or maybe an imagined past. So that was worth poking at a little bit. I feel like a lot of the nostalgia around motorcycles and maybe around music is centered on actually a fairly specific moment in time, a kind of, you know, 10 or 15 year bracket in the 60s and 70s. And I wonder if you think that's true. And if you do, what you think the appeal of that moment is culturally.
Did you mean 60s and 70s for motorcycles, music, or both?
Well, kind of both. I mean, I may be forcing it, and so you don't have to accept that premise. No. but I kind of think both.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I admit, you know, when I'm on my Indian Chief on the highway with my camping gear behind me, right, I feel older and from any era, you know what I mean? And as vain as that is, or as much of a fantasy as that is, it's true. I feel connected, right? And I think when a guitar player or singer is holding an older guitar or singing in front of a 1930s RCA microphone recording on analog tape, they feel more connected to the artist they listen to. I mean, that's kind of the goal, right? It's like I'm writing this, I hope to write a timeless song about love or whatever, and I listen to artists from the 60s and 70s, I'm going to use the same tools they used and somehow hopefully arrive at the same place they arrived. You know, or I get a better shot at it.
Right.
You know, so I think it's healthy. I really do.
Yeah.
In the right doses.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. You know, the mystery of why that era is so appealing. I mean, I just finished watching Apple TV's 1971, which I imagine you've probably seen. And it's just a powerful reminder of how, for whatever reason, how enduring culture from that period, you know, kind of was. And it made me think a bit about, this is going to seem like an impossible leap, but, you know, welcome to my world. It made me think about the CB750. So here's a motorcycle that, you know, attracts just oceans of nostalgic reverence. You know, it's a custom builder's, you know, kind of dream as a platform. There are all kinds of people who think you shouldn't touch them. You know, they're very evocative of the moment in which they kind of landed here. But at the same time, in that moment, that was an incredibly advanced motorcycle. It was not, you know, like a Harley Panhead, something that hadn't, you know, changed in 20 years at that point. It was a show of technological, you know, tour de force. And so I'm wondering if you have a point of view on why we look back on it the way we do, and and I'm still sticking with this parallel to music. Is any of that making sense?
Yeah. You know, I don't have the connection to that bike that I don't feel it's technologically advanced. Right. Because I've always known it. Right. Mm-hmm. I didn't experience the advances that it has. Right. But the nostalgia, like when I first started riding that bike, I was like 20, and it's a hokey looking bike. It really is. You sit upright, you know what I mean? And it's Japanese. And, mm-hmm. and I pulled up to this restaurant in Nashville and backed it between two Harleys. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to get some grief. And they both came over and like, man, this is my first bike. They were like, it was the first bike I had,
right.
And that happens wherever I ride it. And cause usually my fingers are dirty cause I'm having to adjust the idle stops at every stoplight. But I think now I feel that nostalgia for that bike because I've heard so many stories about it, you know, and to think about somebody with a big Harley Davidson walking over to a small Honda and talking about it kind of blew my mind. And I think like the music of the '60s and seventies, it was real. They were breaking ground. You know what I mean? And, you know, we're still breaking ground. Right. I mean, I listen to modern music and I love what's going on with a lot of stuff. Right. But there are certain genres that are just kind of like, not making a whole lot of headway these days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Blues, right? I mean, that's blues is blues, you know? So they harken back to when blues was new and fresh and breaking ground. You know what I mean? So I think that's where it comes from. It's kind of into that, you know? You know, but it is weird with recording. I mean, the equipment that's made today, the called outboard equipment, the stuff you bolt into racks, is very, very high percentage, like older designs, you know, and not a lot of advancement there, which is really strange to me. I talked to like film people I know from LA and they're like, this is the craziest thing ever, man. You know what I mean? No one looks back at older formats of film. You know what I mean?
Right.
We're all in the 8K and 12K and whatever, you know? So that's interesting to me too. So.
And I wonder if maybe, if there are some generational differences in the way that riders think about this. And normally I avoid wading into this particular topic because it, you know, people tend to drop sides, but you know, you strike me as maybe a Gen Xer, so you can cop to that or not cop to that, or, you know,
Yeah.
And that's a group of people who straddled the digital and analog eras, and have even become a bit vocal about that as a sort of, you know, point of pride. And, you know, in a large sense, that generation is the one that actually created the future. The, you know, everybody that, is living it now, inherited it, if you like. Whereas I think for older people, a bike like your CB was literally their past, as you've just, you know, proven in that anecdote. So I kind of wonder, I guess what I'm getting at here is what are the people who don't actually own that past? What is their experience of this? And I think, I bet you there are parallels still, you know, here between motorcyclists and musicians in that sense, because I think you've referred to that earlier in this conversation. If I'm looking at a bike the age of your CB and I wasn't alive when it was built, what is it tugging at for me?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why vinyl records are going crazy right now. It's that, you know, it's the exploration backwards. You know what I mean? And it's the easiest way to get there to the 60s and 70s, you know? Not many people that are in the early 20s can go, man, I wonder what it was like living in the 70s. I should go buy a 72 Mustang fastback. You know what I mean?
Right.
How to drive a stick. No, it's like, let's go buy a record player for a couple hundred bucks and a handful of records for a couple $100. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And experience the thing I already love, which is music, in an older, quote unquote, older way. Right. You know, I'd be curious next time I see a younger person. I'm 46. Next time I see a younger person on an older bike, I'm going to ask them that question. It's like, hey, why are you riding this bike? You know, there's a woman that lives around the corner. This is such a motorcycle story where we were doing the GRG ride a couple years ago, this gentleman's ride, and I recognized her bike. I said, you live over on the west side of Nashville, don't you? And she looked at me and I said, I know your bike. That's a early Honda, you know, it sticks out. She goes, oh yeah, I do. And I should have asked her, why do you ride that bike? You know, is it affordability? It's like, I could afford to buy it. Excellent answer. You know what I mean? It's the right size engine, you know, excellent answer. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a bike that age, I have to think there's more to it. But I definitely take your point. You know, it's funny, about 4 years ago, I had a guest on this podcast who kind of proposed this as an answer. He believed, only partly tongue-in-cheek, that the answer is Steve McQueen. Now, some might argue that the answer to everything is Steve McQueen, but I think what he meant was that that people channel a past that isn't their own because they perceive it to represent something that's missing in their lives or in modern life, if you like. So that something might be freedom or creativity or danger. And the past gets mythologized to sort of, fill that gap. And in Steve McQueen's case, argued my guest, it was a kind of fearless, you know, cool, not giving a damnness that most of us can't or don't dare, pull off today. And I wonder what you think about that. You know, this question will sound much crueler than it's meant to, but when we surround ourselves with this old stuff, are we, as writers or as musicians, are we indulging in a sort of technological cosplay, do you think? Is there something cathartic about it?
Yeah, and I thought you were going to say that the answer is blowing in the wind.
I should have. Good one.
It says the same thing. I bet that if I asked that woman why she rides a bike and I said, is it because of Steve McQueen? She wouldn't know who Steve McQueen is. Right?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
So it's bigger than that. It's bigger than Steve McQueen. Mm. Right. And I was just thinking about all the things that people of all ages, but younger people do that are older, like fashion. Like, why does my 12-year-old daughter wear mom jeans? I don't know, Bruce. Mm. I don't. They're definitely not cool. I don't think they look cool. You can boil it down because they want to be cool. Like, Steve McQueen defined cool in his era, right?
Yeah.
Whatever cool is, I mean, motorcycles are movies all the time and they're cool. It's Tom Cruise and Top Gun on a motorcycle, right? That was cool to me, right? And all of that.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's tough. You throw a lot of tough questions. So.
Well, and meandering questions.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
No, it's cool.
Okay, so here's another take, and I wonder what you think of this. When I was preparing for this interview, I read an article on the subject that suggested that part of the appeal of old machines was their honesty, if I can put it that way, and I'll read you a quote. The writer says, "Behind all of this, I think, is more than a simple sentimentality. In an age when smart devices are outsmarting the best of us, there's a real hunger for machines that do what they say and nothing more." So the craving for old things is about honesty in what sometimes feels like a dishonest age. Does that ring true for you?
Yeah, it totally does. And I kind of touched on it accidentally earlier when I said purpose built. It's like, this thing does one thing. So when I walk up to it, I know what it's going to do. Right?
Yeah.
You know, I think one thing that frustrates me about newer cars is there's a screen and I need to get to my air conditioning controls. I have to toggle through my radio menu.
Right.
You know? You know what I mean? And how do I get it to recirculate? A car I used to have had a button, you know, but, and it's not changing, right? Like my sales pitch with Mara Machines is I'm not going to hit you up in 6 months for a new software you have to download to run this tape machine. Play is going to be play from today on, right? And people respond to that, you know? It's not licensed like software is, it's owned, right? Which I think, you know, it's that purpose built thing that I keep coming back to, you know? So.
Yeah. I had the same reaction.
There's a few ways to answer your questions. I get like frozen. You know, it's like there's so many roads. So I'm just going to crash into a tree, you know? So,
that's on me. Because I don't actually think there is an answer to this. I think we're going to wind up deciding that, the best way to deal with this is to not pick a side at all. Which maybe we'll get to in a minute, but I did warn you at the beginning of this conversation that I was going to ask how you decide which bike you're going to ride.
Yeah, okay. So this week's been a rough week. And Tuesday I went out to the garage to go for a ride and I was a little too keyed up to ride the Ducati, but I wanted to go fast. So I wasn't going to think about anything else but riding a motorcycle.
Right.
But not that fast. Because I needed to relieve stress. And sometimes you can do that with, you know, a throttle. And the brake isn't enough, you know. So I rode, like, the Bonneville. Or I think I rode the BMW because you can really get on it and you feel like you're going fast, but you're really not, you know. It's a mood thing. It totally is a mood thing because they're all different. It's all a different experience. It really is, you know, and who I'm going to ride with, you know, you can't ride a Ducati with a bunch of people on beggars. You just can't. It's a miserable experience.
Right.
And conversely, I can't ride my Indian with a bunch of sport bikes. It's a miserable experience. So it's more about like how I'm feeling. You know, where do I want to test some skills? Do I want to feel that, you know, a little bit of fear, which is excitement, which I heard one of your guests say, or do I just want to chill out and just put my feet up on the pegs, you know?
Yeah.
So, distance of the ride, you know, you can't ride a lot of those bikes more than a couple hours, you know? So,
yeah,
but that's they're all purposely in my garage to fill a certain spot that I need filled.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and so I feel the same way. I don't have quite as many bikes, but for me the decision I ride alone most of the time, and for me the decision about which bike to ride is almost unconscious. I just know which key I'm going to reach for, and you know, in a sense, I think that this was sort of meant to lay some pipe for the next, I guess maybe the money question. You know, when people talk about old stuff versus new stuff, I mean, occasionally you'll find online people arguing about the moral superiority of a carburetor, you know, over fuel injection, or the moral failure of choosing ABS. You know, it kind of tends to devolve into this binary, you know, which is better argument. But it seems to me that's not how you feel about it. I don't think that's how maybe musicians feel about it. It's not how I feel about it. You know, it's not really a matter of picking a side, but maybe just enjoying the fact that you've got a richer palette to work with. Do you see it that way? I guess I bet you do. Can you talk about that a bit?
Sure, yeah. And I hit a breaking point with that conversation, my world, analog versus digital, while I was on a panel. And I found myself, when I thought I was having a discussion with an audience member, he was having an argument with me about which is better, analog or digital. And he was telling me what he thought digital was better. And I politely just asked him, well, how much analog recording experience do you have? And not to challenge him, I was just trying to like, I was on in search of an analogy I could work with, right? And he said, well, I don't have any. And I didn't snap, but I just had this realization of, I said, well, go get 20 years of experience on it or some, and then we can have a discussion on which is better, because you're not equipped to have that discussion right now.
Right.
And I feel that on the forums. In the Facebook groups, you know, it's just like people are overly commenting about their experiences as being better, even though they haven't had an equal experience in whatever they're talking about. So I am not anti anything. I'm like, whatever you got, there's no superiority with a carburetor or a tube guitar amp or any, it's just stuff that we use to go places. And feeling the quick response of fuel injection puts a smile on my face. Feeling the lag on a hot day from a carburetor puts a smile on my face. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For different reasons. You know what I mean? I tell younger people that work for me when we go to trade shows or we go to these events, I'm like, or parties, or if we have parties, if you get engaged in a conversation where someone is just being negative and nitpicking the process, just walk away. Mm-hmm. There's a better conversation happening where you're going to learn something about an approach or an idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just walk away, you know, and I pieced out of a debate on Facebook this spring. I put a 6-speed transmission, or I had a 6-speed transmission put on by Indian, because I always wanted it, because it needed a 6th gear, in my opinion.
Mm.
And people were telling me that it wasn't the right move, and that the 5-speed's better. And I said, I've had this bike 7 years, you know, put a lot of miles on it. And I just put it, you know, I put a 6-speed on the same exact bike, and I like it better. I'm going to go ride it.
Right.
You know what I mean? You can discuss which is better. I'm going to go ride it. You know, is what I said politely, you know, so that all those discussions are just, to me, just so boring.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, me too. Me too. I mean, why do you think anybody even cares? You know, not to digress this into a people are mean on the internet conversation, but why do you think people even care about this kind of thing?
I don't know that they do care about it. I think it's just something they can talk about. So when we host tape camps here, people come around the country to talk about recording, and it's the anti-forum. It's the anti-online forum is what I call it, even though I'm not against anything. But it's my answer to it, I should say. And I feel, let's use carburetors and analog recording. I think people that talk about carburetors being better, I think they do it consciously or subconsciously to say that they're better at what they do.
Right.
Or that they don't want to mess with a carburetor, so they ride a newer bike. So they demonize a carburetor, right? So, well, you have to adjust it every 2,000 miles and the jets always get dirty. And none of that's true. You know what I mean? None of that's true. Same thing on the recording. It's like, oh, you have to calibrate the machine every morning and this and that and this and that, so I don't use it. No, none of that's true. You know what I mean? You just don't use it because you decided not to, or you can't afford one, or you're not good enough, and that's that. Moving on.
Right.
if people didn't have these discussions, I think Facebook's net worth would be a lot less.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't be on there talking about it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of motorcycle culture happens online anymore, especially, you know, since the pandemic. And it's hard to watch sometimes for just the reasons that you say. And this subject is one of the most mystifying to me. You know, a motorcycle's job, at least in our society, is to be fun. And whatever that means on a given day seems like self-justifying to me.
And about forums is the, in my world, I think probably in any world, but recording and motorcycles, it's like the people that are commenting the most are doing the activity they're talking about the least.
Right. I suspect that might be true.
But as a reader or someone on the forum, you don't know that. The black and white letters look very authoritative no matter who types them, you know? So,
I watched you answer a similar question to this on a podcast. And in this case, you were talking about recording gear. And I think you made reference to this quote earlier in our conversation, too. You said if it sounds good, they would have had it in 1979, which presumably means they would have had it if they could have had it. And I wonder if maybe that's, you know, part of the answer here, too, the sort of key to accepting this dichotomy and, you know, why there aren't sides. I'm okay with ABS because they would have offered it in 1979 if they could have, that sort of thing. Do you want to expand on that a bit? Do I have that right?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, that's, you know, a designer, a motorcycle designer called an engineer. I'd say that because I'm an engineer, but a recording engineer, are in my vision of how this works is they're talking to riders and riders want to go faster. They want to stop faster. They want all these things. And the engineers figure out how to do that, right? That is fuel injection. That is ABS. That is traction control. Yeah. That's all those things so they can go faster. And every time you go faster, it has to be, you know, oh, that's too fast. Let's make it safer. You know what I mean? Right. Like, I think ABS came right after fuel injection. You know, it's like, whoa, now we're going fast.
Yep.
Oh, these brakes are not good anymore. You know, we thought those were good brakes, right? So that's where the whole thing to me is just confusing. And same with recording equipment of certain eras, I'm going to phrase that, where the recording equipment designers were tied very closely to musicians and their needs to make this better and better and better, you know? So that's where better. A strange word, right? Yeah.
Better for what and better for who?
So ABS is a lot better for the pedestrian you didn't hit.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Or the car you didn't T-bone.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That might be the strangest argument of all. So I think if I remember correctly, you're about to leave for a big ride out west. What's the plan, and are you riding something with a soul?
That's to be determined. So this is so fun, you know. It's like my daughter is going with me. We're flying to Portland, Oregon, renting a BMW R1200, which I've never ridden. Mm. I've never ridden one of those. And we're riding the coastal highway down to San Francisco for 5 days, 4 days, 5 days. And it was just so fun because as a parent, you hang out with your kids and you try to get them on motorcycles. And our winter project 1 year was we just tore apart that Honda. And I gave them each a carburetor, you know, and we did the whole thing, right? And I didn't think they liked it at all. And then years later, I was kind of planning this trip and I had reached out to some friends and their schedules didn't align. And Madeline, my daughter, said, well, can I go with you? And I know 12-year-olds enough to have really had to work on not being excited. She asked me, I was like, yeah, okay, we can talk about that. And inside I'm like, and you know, it's gonna be interesting. My wife wasn't too thrilled, you know, about, you know, riding 700 miles with my daughter on the back of a motorcycle. Even to me it's the same as 10 miles, right? I mean, but we're gonna have a blast. It's a total bucket list ride for me. The fact that she wants to go with me, if it's a disaster as far as weather or we don't get along in the ride or whatever, it's still going to be a great trip. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is a bucket list trip for me too. And I bet for lots of people, it sounds glorious. And I completely relate to your comment about having to conceal your glee. I think the choice of bikes is interesting too, because the BMW you have is a boxer also. So you're going to experience, you know, 40 years of development on that concept. You'll have to email me when you're back and let me know how that went. I think they're amazing bikes, actually.
Yeah, and it, you know, it wasn't the choice was whittled down for me because the company, I think it's called MotoQuest.
Right.
Fantastic to deal with. I'm not endorsed. they have offices in like Anchorage, Alaska, San Francisco, Portland, San Francisco, and Long Beach. And you can rent and ride to each of those locations for a $100 drop-off fee.
Wow.
Of other car rental and motorcycle rentals, it's huge amounts of money to drop off at a different location. So they're geared to ride the coast, right? And they only offer the GS and RT.
Hmm.
And they actually suggested the GS, which is the adventure bike. And I'm gonna be on the road the whole time. I want to try an RT, you know. And I forget the woman's name who took my reservation. She's like, well, I said, is there a cost difference in the bikes? And she goes, no, we just tell people to save up $25,000 because they're going to want to buy one when they get done. But she said so. And truth you know, and I've got a Facebook Marketplace RT saved. So, but I'm excited about that. We got geared up, literally, like, got her a helmet with comms. So, you know, it's kind of cool. We went shopping for a cool jacket for her, and it's just fun. You know what I mean? Just, my daughter is really not, she's still in shock that we're going to each have 5 days of clothing in one backpack. She's going to have her backpack with 5 days of clothing. I'm going to have mine. And I said, it's easy. 3 t-shirts, 5 pairs of underwear, some socks. And she's like, Dad, we are 2 completely different people. So
I am jealous. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. From what I understand, the big GS is a superb touring machine. You know, even if you never, you know, see a foot of gravel, they're apparently just brilliant at that job. So I think you'd be glad. Well, listen, Chris, it's been a blast speaking with you. I really loved the topic, and I'm so glad you suggested it. And thanks for the insights from the, you know, that other world you inhabit. I'm relying on my listeners here to be patient that, you know, in the event that their fascination with that world is, you know, maybe not exactly what mine is. But I think there were some insights here we might not have got any other way. So thank you. I think you're right. Musicians and motorcyclists are not so different all the time. This was really fun.
Yeah, I had a blast. And thank you so much. It's fun to talk about the things I talk about from a different angle, you know, and I do apologize. I wish I would have had better answers sometimes. But that's a testament to how good the questions were. I didn't have a ready-made.
You're very kind. You're very kind. I feel like I might've been a little self-indulgent with this one, but you kind of say so. And I thought your answers were fantastic and patient.
Oh man. I had so much fun. I had so much fun. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Have fun on your trip too and ride safe.
Will do. Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
To this episode, I mentioned my interview with Eric Buell last spring, and I found myself thinking quite a lot about that as I listened back to the conversation you just heard. We obviously covered some of the same ground, but talking with Chris gave me a sort of bookend to Eric's take that I think I've been looking for. Eric Buell is an engineer at heart, and at the heart of his argument was the rational certainty that motorcycles are going to get better and better. Well, that was comforting. But Chris is an enthusiast who comes from a world where you don't have to reject the past in order to appreciate the future. You just have to be deliberate about what's worth keeping around and why. It's a perspective I think you can only have when you're not invested, either in the past or the future, which for you and me is probably the happiest way to ride through all this change. There really isn't a side to take, as it turns out. After all, as Chris put it, this is just stuff we use to go places, whether those places are in our minds, I suppose, or on a map. And as for the matter of soul, well, he figures all it takes is that a machine be built with a purpose and then used for that purpose, regardless of when it was built. Which means that any bike can have one. And that whichever instrument we choose, if you'll forgive the lame analogy, the music is still up to us. That's one thing that'll never change. Well, thanks for listening. You'll find show notes for this episode at thismotorcyclelife.com. That's also how you can reach me if you have questions, comments, or suggestions about the show. Emailing me at thismotorcyclelife@gmail.com works too, and I'd love to hear your stories. You can still find me lurking on Instagram too, where I'm at thismotolife, and where you'll also find many of the people I've interviewed for this podcast, including Chris Mara. Well, this episode's playlist recommendation was chosen by Chris Mara, and it was recorded at Chris's studio. The band are folk rockers Corey Chisel and the Wandering Sons, who hail from Appleton, Wisconsin. The track is called 17, and Chris thought it was a fitting way to end this episode since so many of us feel like kids on our bikes. It's a little wistful, but it's a good reminder that time waits for nobody, or for their motorcycles. Buy it or stream it wherever you like to get your music. And in the meantime, keep staying alive out there.
I am not 17 anymore. That's not what you're buying. And I ain't staying clean anymore.